Raymond saw himself as an oil and gas purist. He told colleagues that outside its headquarters, the corporation should carve in stone the words crude oil. He felt that it was critical that Exxon not get confused about what we are trying to do around here. He and Rawl had employed their drill sergeant-inspired ethos to direct a sharp turn in corporate strategy away from an era during the 1960s and 1970s when Exxon had tried to adapt itself partially to environmentalism. Rawl's predecessor as chairman, Clifton Garvin, a chemical engineer, had gone so far as to install solar panels to heat the swimming pool at his suburban New Jersey home. Besides cost-cutting, they sought to restore Exxon's focus on its core business. Some of his colleagues believed Raymond possessed a one-of-a-kind analytical mind and memory, and that his acuity contributed mightily to Exxon's superior business and Wall Street performance. At a time of wage stagnation and other rising cost pressures on working and middle-class American families, this success enriched many Exxon employees and increasingly set those located in the United States apart as an economically secure class. Exxon managers had jobs for life if they could hack the corporation's internal systems and were willing to move from place to place. They enjoyed secure, defined benefit pension plans and restricted stock that would make many middle and upper managers millionaires if they stayed long enough and managed their personal finances carefully. Exxon managers tolerated Raymond's tirades in part because they understood, as the years passed, that he was making them rich. This was not Silicon Valley. The corporation's scientists and division chiefs did not walk away with fortunes at 35, but if they conformed and performed, they would rise gradually on a tide of oil profits into an economically privileged elite. Raymond reserved a particular scorn for the Wall Street analysts who published commentary about Exxon's business strategy. After years of sporadic efforts to engage with analysts, the corporation began to stage an annual meeting with analysts. It was an unusual hearts and minds campaign because during the question and answer session, it was rare for Raymond to respond to any query without first challenging the analyst's assumptions or intelligence.
"This is going to be a tough meeting. You ought to take 2 patience pills," Peter Townsend, the vice president for investor relations and corporate secretary, would warn him before these sessions.
"No, 3.
If Raymond began his answer to an analyst's question with, "frankly," or "to be candid with you," it was a signal to duck. He started one meeting at the New York Stock Exchange by noting that executives from the Walt Disney Company were also present in the building that morning.
"I don't think Mickey or his friend Goofy are going to join us, but I may have to hold my judgment on that until after the Q&A session."
Raymond served, in effect, as the corporation's chief financial officer, in possession of all of the critical numbers. By the time he became chairman, he had also served for years as a director at J.P. Morgan, the Wall Street investment bank. During the mid-1980s, Exxon's financial performance looked respectable but undistinguished in comparison with its oil industry peers. Rawl's cost-cutting and reorganization campaign was intended to force improvements. In 1987, Rawl began to place heavy emphasis on a metric called Return on Capital Employed, or ROCE, often spoken of as ROCE. This was a performance measure that sought to show how well a particular Exxon business unit, and overall the corporation, used the cash it borrowed or recycled from earnings to reap returns from new projects. After he took charge, Raymond campaigned on Wall Street to have his particular measure of ROCE recognized as the premier number by which oil corporations should be judged. He argued repeatedly to analysts that oil companies were very long-term businesses that consumed a great deal of capital and that, ultimately, they should be judged not by quarterly profits or share price fluctuations, but by how well they managed their investments. Whether, for example, they regularly destroyed capital by leasing unproductive oil fields, failing to manage costs on huge drilling projects, or by building unprofitable refineries. The deep cost-cutting continued by Raymond raised Exxon's rates of return on capital. So did the drive Raymond advanced to improve Exxon's relatively low-profit divisions, particularly gasoline refining. The downstream divisions of integrated oil companies like Exxon were generally much less profitable than the upstream units that found, pumped, and sold crude oil and gas. Downstream was an industry term that referred to what took place after oil was pumped from the ground and sold, the refining of oil into gasoline or aviation fuel, and retail sales to motorists at thousands of Exxon-branded gasoline stations across the United States. Exxon had long tolerated low downstream profit margins, and even occasional losses, because having huge refineries worldwide gave the corporation a built-in market for its own oil sales. In effect, upstream profits subsidized the downstream. By maintaining a focus on ROCE inside Exxon and preaching about it on Wall Street, and by tying performance on that number to promotions and bonuses for Exxon managers, Raymond hoped to create change. Exxon's rates of return on capital rose sharply during the 1990s, declined as oil prices fell late in the decade, and then recovered to a record level of about 20% by the decade's end, superior to any competitor. Raymond was only partly successful in persuading others to embrace his math. Although no other major industry adopted his ideas about ROCE's centrality as a metric, Exxon's major oil company rivals did start to report their own ROCE numbers to Exxon's benefit. ROCE was, in any event, a somewhat arbitrary figure by which to compare oil giants. The measure favored ExxonMobil's relative strengths as an operator in low-margin downstream and chemical divisions. For investors, all companies highlighted the numbers that made them look best. Certainly, ROCE was a long-standing and valid way to measure a corporation's ability to maintain profit discipline across many projects over many years. Still, about two-thirds of an oil company's ROCE is typically explained by commodity prices, as James J. Mulva, the chief executive officer of ConocoPhillips, once remarked. His company's ROCE scores lagged. That is, the most sparkling annual ROCE numbers, in comparison with returns seen in other industries, often reflected factors in the global oil market beyond any one company's control. That was apparent in ExxonMobil's own yo-yoing numbers. Yet within the oil industry, ROCE scores did provide a basis to compare operating and capital efficiency. Raymond understood the distortions caused by swings in oil prices, but he thought the number was as good a way as any available to judge management's long-term investment discipline. "Our competitors hated it," Raymond recalled. "The reason they hated it is that it's a report card, and while everyone can talk about individual projects and how attractive they may appear to be, ultimately, over time, you have to look at, well, how do all of those individual projects add up?"